Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I got my booster yesterday, so my arm's a little sore, but otherwise I feel pretty good. Yeah, a little, but no big deal. So let me encourage you, if you are like I am, over 65, and you qualify for a booster, to get yours, because, you know, even breakthrough COVID could be really nasty. Anyhow, today we've got a lot coming up on the program. I want to get into my rant today over at HartmanReport.com. Have we gone too far down the road toward fascism to stop an authoritarian takeover of our nation? Or is there still time for genuine patriots to rescue our nation? What will it take? Also, I want to get into a fascinating observation from Tom Nichols, the writer over at The Atlantic. I'll just be telling you about it. He's not going to be on the show, but he's got this piece suggesting that the whole ongoing Republican Party and the Trump coup basically exists as a space for people who are so mediocre or even incompetent that they literally couldn't make a living anywhere else, or at least not the kind of living they can make in Trump world by grifting people. We'll get to that. Greg Palast is going to drop by about the California oil spills and the whole toxic hole, H-O-L-E, that is the port of Los Angeles. And an update on the fellow that was at Chevron, I guess, prosecuted. Hired a private prosecutor. It's blah. This is crazy. And we'll get to that. Professor Richard Wolff is going to drop by. Are people rejecting the "do you want fries with that" kind of minimum wage economy? What's going on here? What has, you know, the supply chains and all this stuff, and changes in employment, and a whole bunch of people leaving their jobs in the last 6 months? Anyhow, we'll get to that. So to start out. And I only came up with a partial list here, right? You know, if you see things that I'm missing, if you've got some good ones or big ones, I can always edit my article here. The title of the piece, "How Far Down the Road Towards Fascism Has America Gone?" This is one of the cool things about writing on Substack, is that I can, in real time, I can just add things to my op-eds. But, well, first of all, you know, kind of what got me started on this. The last time that Louise and I were hanging out with Tom Hayden was back in 2007 at the Praxis Peace Conference in Dubrovnik. But this is a guy who had changed my life, and I made sure he knew about this. You know, in the early 1960s, I think it was 62, he authored, or co-authored, he was the principal author of SDS's Port Huron Statement. Now, this is before the Vietnam War. And so Students for Democratic Society was started to explicitly advocate for minorities, particularly for African Americans in the United States, you know, as basically kind of a white student ally movement to a certain extent, but also a lot of outreach and bring people in, and for Democrat, you know, for democracy, for social justice in the United States, and the idea of democracy. And I think it's really important that we ask this question that Tom started. I mean, you know, in 1962, I was probably about a decade younger than Tom, but at that point in time, we thought that the world might be destroyed by a nuclear bomb. It hadn't occurred to us that the world might be destroyed by Donald Trump, But anyhow, Tom wrote in one of the opening paragraphs, actually, of the Port Huron statement. He said, "Our work is guided by the sense that we may be the last generation in the experiment with living." And I can tell you from having been active in SDS back during that time that there was very much that sense. Although by the time I got real active in SDS, which was 67, 68, 69, it had become the nexus, a central focus, a central locus of the anti-Vietnam War movement. But I think it's important for us to ask this question. You'll recall that college professor, the Milton Mayer, I've quoted him many times, the Milton Mayer interviewed after World War II, the German college professor, and Mayer basically said, "How did you guys, let this happen?" And the college professor said, "To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me." And then he goes on, he says, there were all these changes, but every one was just one small change, and it was just one small news cycle, and we let that one go on, and the next one. And finally, he says, "One no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing, and one day it's over his head." So, given that, and the 60s were really a very different time also, in that while we had a president, Lyndon Johnson, who was sending my friends off to, some of my friends off to war to die, a death sentence by draft, at the same time, he put into law in 64, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, a massive social welfare programs that lifted people out of poverty, that helped build the middle class, the American middle class, until Reagan started taking it apart in the 1980s. But I think from that time, we couldn't have imagined what would happen in the next 50 years. What has happened since that time, since the 60s? In the United States. In 76, 78, and then doubling down in 2010 with Citizens United, the Supreme Court legalized political corruption, what we were talking about yesterday in the context of, for example, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. President Bush authorized extrajudicial murder, kidnapping, and torture of non-citizens. President Obama authorized the first legal assassination of an American citizen on foreign soil. Both parties, both political parties, it started with Jimmy Carter in 78, but, Reagan turned it into official U.S. policy in the 80s, followed both Chile and the United Kingdom down this neoliberal road of throwing open our economy to foreign competition for the first time, literally since the founding of the Republic, and the result was 60,000 factories closed, more than 10 million jobs lost. And that then produces its own social ferment, which we're seeing right now, frankly, in my opinion, in the whole Trumpy movement. We've had repeated tax cuts shifting tens of trillions of dollars out of the pockets of middle class and working class people and into the pockets of the top 1% so completely that, as Bernie Sanders tweeted a couple of days ago, the top 1%'s wealth now exceeds that of the entire American middle class. Let that sink in. The Electoral College loophole in our Constitution let George W. Bush become president, even though he lost the 2000 election by 500,000 votes, and let Donald Trump become president in 2016, even though he lost the election to Hillary Clinton by 3 million votes. President Reagan ordered the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission to stop enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, the Antitrust Act of 1956, the Clayton Antitrust Act, I forget what year that was passed, somewhere in there in the 30s or early 40s. He basically stopped all that, and then Bill Clinton in 96 signed the Telecommunications Act, and so as a result now, we've got this bizarre situation where hard right poison, at this moment as I am speaking, is pouring out of 3 cable television networks, 200-plus television stations in the Sinclair network, 1,500 radio stations in English and an estimated 200 to 300 radio stations in Spanish. Again, something the Democratic Party is not noticing and is going to bite them in the ass really badly. Ronald Reagan reversed Congress's assertion in the 1930s that unions could be legal and had legal protection, and thus now in America only about 6% of the private workforce has such protections. We've got a movement of armed militias denying the authority of the U.S. government. They basically declared war on liberal democracy so completely that they led an assault on the U.S. Capitol and were within minutes of assassinating the Vice President of the United States and the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Our intelligence agencies launched a massive surveillance program that caught us all up in its web, as Edward Snowden laid out. The Republican Party has, almost without exception, embraced the idea that elections not only can be rigged, but should be rigged to their advantage. They passed over 30 laws in 19 states to rig the 2022 and 2024 elections in advance. Multiple Republican states have passed laws decriminalizing killing people on public streets by driving cars into crowds of demonstrators. Voting rights legislation is being blocked not only by every single Republican in the United States Senate, but by two United States Democratic U.S. senators, Sinema and Manchin, because it would take ending the filibuster to stop blocking voting rights legislation. An entire generation of students, this didn't even exist in the 60s. You know, people went to college in the 60s. You know, you could work a part-time job. I worked pumping gas at a gas station and as a dishwasher at Bob's Big Boy. And you could pay for your college tuition that way. Not anymore. An entire generation of students are saddled with crippling debt. Over 40% of Medicare has now been privatized through the Medicare Advantage scam. An estimated 1 million American families will go bankrupt this year just because somebody gets sick. Fewer than a quarter of all high school graduates have even taken one single class in civics, leaving the two generations since Reagan's change in our education systems basically unaware of how democracies are supposed to work. We had a president, Donald Trump, who brazenly and nakedly lied to the American people literally every single day of his presidency and continues to do so. You have multiple members of Congress who committed an act of sedition, and their consequence has been re-election and being turned into media stars. Hitler, when he came back in, you know, when he made his comeback in 1925 after his failed attempt at overthrowing the Bavarian government in 1923, he took the widow of one of the guys who was shot by the police and turned her into a national martyr. And Trump is trying to do that now with Ashley Babbitt. The Republican Party has embraced dictatorial foreign governments manipulating our electorate, whether it's through social media or whatever. They've embraced presidents making millions off their office. They've embraced oligarchy in the USA. We've got a 37-year-old billionaire who single-handedly owns the world's largest single source of news. And according to a whistleblower, is subordinating human rights, democracy, and common decency to profit. And our planet is warmed over in full degrees Celsius. We've got this climate crisis. Have we gone too far? Can we pull back from this? I believe we can, but it's getting more challenging every day, it seems.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And on top of all this, the U.S. Supreme Court is refusing to acknowledge their own ruling in Roe v. Wade, triggering a huge constitutional crisis. Tom Hartman here with you. I think this message that Tom Nichols laid out in The Atlantic is absolutely fascinating. He's pointing to, for example, Stephanie Grisham. And basically, any collection of people who worked in the Trump White House, up to and including, I would say, even, you know, the uber grifters in the Trump family, you know, Eric and in particular, Ivanka and Jared, that these are extraordinarily mediocre people. They're people that, you know, Bob Dole wouldn't have had in his administration. Bob Dole was never president, but ran for it. George W. Bush never would have had in his administration. Ronald Reagan wouldn't have had people like this in his administration. Bush Sr. wouldn't have had people like this in his administration. Obviously, Obama, Clinton wouldn't have. In fact, I can't think of a time in my lifetime when there have been such absolutely mediocre people, or even just pathetically incompetent. Jeffrey Bossert Clark, the guy who came up with the plan for Trump to overthrow, you know, to use the Justice Department to overturn the 2020 election and become dictator for life. He was such a mediocre lawyer that they wanted to hire him into the Justice Department because he'd been a loyal right-wing foot soldier. So they put him, you know, they put him in this remote, weird part of the Justice Department that has to do with environmental law. And, you know, I mean, and then Trump wanted to make him attorney general. And now he's, you know, he got caught, you know, when he fell, right, after Trump left office. He's now employed by, you know, one of these billionaire-funded right-wing think tanks, which is the place where mediocre people go to, you know, live out their retirement or whatever. But this is just so strange. Tom Nichols says, we are in a constitutional crisis. It's not looming. It's not ahead of us. It's here. And I absolutely agree with that. And in fact, I would say that the Supreme Court not enforcing their own ruling in Roe v. Wade, even temporarily, is proof that we are in a constitutional crisis. But I think it goes beyond that. He says the threat to American democracy increased exponentially over the past 5 years when mediocre people of meager talents realized they would never have to work a straight job again as long as they could terrify a nation of right-wing nitwits around the end of the so-called real America. I'm seeing the same thing happening over at Fox News and on other right-wing media. I mean, I used to debate some of these people who are now media stars on Fox News. And mediocre doesn't even begin to describe how mediocre these people are. Is the Republican Party going to make it through? Are we going to make it through? Pick up your calls after this. Tom in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good to hear you, Tom. I got two main points. One is the whole Trump playbook is a psychological ploy based on an ancient archetype, thousands of years old, good versus evil, villain versus hero.
Sure.
And he always treats everyone else as a villain and himself as the hero. Thus, when people vote, everyone wants to vote for a hero, not a villain.
I agree.
Yeah, and the second big thing is this demonization is so bad. I have a lifelong friend up in Washington. I'm in California. He said, "Oh, you're living in a communist state now." And I'm just going to start calling them the way I look because I looked at 200 videos from this guy in 2 years, researched each one, and 90% of them was Breitbart, RT News, Russian videos. So I'm starting to call all Trumpers Russian communist propaganda sympathizers.
Yeah, except that the Russians aren't communists anymore. They're uber capitalists and oligarchs. But everything else, yeah, I get it. And it's, by the way, there's now increasing evidence that a lot of the churn, a lot of the trolls on social media are not just coming from Russia. That the, you know, the people pretending to be Americans and stoking outrage and trying to get people out in the streets, that they're also coming from China. You know, we're in a conflict with China. That they're also coming from Saudi Arabia and the United. Actually, it was the United Arab Emirates that was fingered in one of the news stories. I mean, we've got literally foreign governments that do not like, you know, a pesky democracy hanging around in the world, setting an example for the world to the extent that we used to anyway. And they're trying to bring us down. But on everything else, I'm with you. I'm with you. Thank you very much, Tom. Great to hear from you. Les in Winnemucca, Nevada. Hey, Les, what's on your mind today?
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Your previous caller there just kind of stole my thunder. Mine's from, you know, Trump's just a con man. And that's all he's ever been.
Oh, yeah.
And he latched on to the Republican Party and his whole presidency has been a con job.
But see, that's the thing. The whole Republican Party has been a con job since 1980 when Reagan was elected. It's been a grift. It's a 40-year-long grift.
Yeah, they've kind of turned into that, and it's too bad because we need people that can think critically on both sides of an issue, but people that are trying to solve the issue, not create problems.
Right.
And Sinema and Manchin, I realize that they're getting their money from, you know, where they're getting it. And so they feel that they've got a problem. But sometimes you got to just turn around and tell your donor, look, I'm going to watch that for you all I can. Mm-hmm. But this time you got to bite the bullet. You're going to have to take one. And there's one other thing I want to say real quick, and then I'll get out of here. I don't understand why the rich class isn't willing to feed the goose that's laying them the golden egg.
You're talking the working class.
Yeah.
Why the rich people won't feed the working class.
It makes no sense to me either, Les.
In the grand scheme, it seems very, very short-sighted, but it's like this is something they've been doing for 7,000 years. So, you know, it's like this, you know, the rule of the rich goes back literally to ancient Sumeria.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Our old buddy Greg Palast, the investigative journalist, author of his most recent book, How Trump Stole 2020. GregPalast.com is the website. Greg_Palast is his Twitter handle. Greg, welcome back. You've got quite an oil spill out there in California from a, the official story is a boat dropped an anchor and it hit a pipeline. Tell us about this.
Okay, the company is called Amplify, but let's not forget whose oil this is. The number one driller off the coast of California. And by the way, why are we drilling off of Huntington Beach, Surf City? I hope that doesn't age me. You know the Beach Boys song, Surf City, USA. That's Huntington Beach.
I didn't know that.
So why are we drilling for oil right off the beach? Ask Chevron. They are the number one driller in California. Their headquarters are here. They are, if there's any, they are the kind of landlords of California. People don't realize how powerful Chevron is. When this planet is awash in oil, there's a temporary, you know, shortage because of shipping. But, you know, we have Venezuela, which we have blocked from shipping to the United States, which, you know, could provide 4 million barrels a day. Why are, of all the places in the world, why are we going off the beaches of California? It's crazy. Yes, Amplify is the company. They have a,
That's the pipeline company?
The pipeline company which gathers from those Chevron and other and other drilling platforms a ship. It looks like a ship, German ship, may have dropped anchor. There are 60 ships waiting off the port of California because we've become so China dependent on manufacturing that they're backed up way out into the ocean. So they're finding places to float around while they're waiting to get into the port of California. But one thing I want to point out, bringing us to our other case that we've talked about, we're talking about 132,000 gallons of oil. And let me tell you, it's not pretty, it's poisonous, it's awful, it's destructive, and it will be there for years in the water column, in the soil, in the seafood off of California. That's 132,000 gallons versus 16 billion gallons, which Chevron has admitted it has dumped into the Amazon rainforest in Ecuador.
Whoa.
Which is the other case we're talking about.
That was the Donziger case.
Yes.
Wow. So it's a good question. When did the drilling off the coast of California start?
Sometime after we were, we've always had drilling in California. It's one of the number one sources of oil in America for a long time.
Yeah, back in the 20s.
But Wally Hickel, under Nixon's Secretary of Interior, said stop the drilling off of California after we had a big spill off Santa Barbara. We shouldn't be drilling Right next to populated areas in particular. It's just completely nuts, especially in that ocean area.
Right.
So even, Nixon's Republican Interior Secretary, by the way, he was a big oil man. He's a billionaire. He was a billionaire who made his money in oil. But he said, drilling off California, that's nuts. And he tried to stop it.
Wow.
It's completely insane. But you have to ask, this is about politics, not about oil. You know, one of the advantages that they have a refinery right here in Los Angeles at Compton and El Segundo, which is why Compton is left as a ghetto area, because that's a sludge area. It's a toxic area.
Right.
We have massive toxic, you know, even before this spill, I got to tell you, Tom, I was just speaking to Bill Gallegos, one of the environmental justice lawyers down in the port area. He said that's a toxic hellhole right now because of the shipping, the massive, ridiculous amount of imports we are bringing in, plus the oil drilling right there.
Yeah. And so, how does this affect California politics? I mean, is there I'm guessing that this oil spill, if nothing else, is going to ignite a new anti-drilling off the coast movement.
You would think. The problem is that, like I say, Chevron is headquartered here in Richmond, California. They are the biggest driller here. They're a massive employer, and politicians are scared to death of taking them on. I saw this even with Jerry Brown as governor, Newsom. They're just not taking. They're not going to take on Chevron. They're just not going to. And that's who's drilling off the coast.
Right. Huh. Amazing. Wow. So what's the latest on this Donziger guy who
So Stephen Donziger, just for you haven't been following, just very quickly, Stephen Donziger 28 years ago sued Chevron Corporation on behalf of the Cofan indigenous tribe deep in the rainforest of Ecuador, where they had admittedly dumped 16 million gallons of oil into the rainforest. Chevron fought to have the case put into Ecuador. They lost there after an eight-year trial, massive scientific evidence. They were ordered to pay $9.5 billion to clean up the mess. There would be no compensation, by the way, to the Cofan natives. I was down there investigating for BBC, and I met the victims who were poisoned, who lost their children to childhood leukemias. They're getting nothing. But at least they were supposed to get a cleanup by Chevron. Instead, Chevron snuck out all its assets out of Ecuador and then sued Donziger, the lawyer, the human rights lawyer. Now, this is a guy who went to Harvard Law School with Barack Obama, but he's broke. And Chevron's gone after him now. They charged him. They sued him for racketeering. They shopped around, found a right-wing judge who convicted him without a trial of racketeering, saying he tried to bribe the judge in Ecuador. That's why he won the case. He supposedly was going to give this judge a $500,000. This judge was paid, ready, $2 million by Chevron to come up to the U.S. and testify against Donziger. That's not a bribe, right? And just so you know, Donziger and his co-lawyer, Pablo Fajardo, in Ecuador, they didn't have I'm not kidding you, they didn't have cab money to get to the courtroom in Ecuador. The idea that they're bribing anyone, it's a joke. And in fact, so what happened is that Donziger was then ordered to turn over his computer so Chevron could see if they had any more of his money to take. They've bankrupted him. They've taken all the money he has in every account he has to pay their supposed legal bills. They spent over $1 billion fighting this guy. I kid you not. And now they're asking the Cofan Indians to pay as well millions and millions to Chevron for their legal costs. And these are the victims of Chevron. And just so you know, I'm holding up for those, if you're on the radio, you can just hear the tinkling. The Cofan, how much money do they have? When they didn't even have currency until recently. This was it. What I was shaking there was a necklace of shells and feathers. That was their currency. And so I guess Chevron's going to take their, what are they going to do, take the feathers now? And now, on top of it, Donziger was, as we know from my report last Friday, was sentenced to 6 months in prison for refusing to turn over his cell phone and computer with his client's private information on it to Chevron. He's been ordered to serve 6 months in prison for a misdemeanor contempt, which a sentence has never been given to anyone in American history. It was not.
Wait a minute, Greg. People get thrown in jail all the time for defying. Yeah. Discovery. I mean, you know, in fact, there's a lot of us hoping that that's what happens to Donald Trump.
Yeah, but what's happened is it doesn't happen. No lawyer has ever been sentenced to 6 months in prison. And in addition, he's been under house arrest for over 2 years. No one in American history that we could find in the records, a legal case, has ever been sentenced to house arrest for a misdemeanor, like, you know, having a joint in your pocket. And in addition, the prosecution of Donziger and the orders against the COFAN were done by a Chevron lawyer ordered by the court. When the Justice Department refused to prosecute Donziger, the judge hired, at public expense, spending about $1 million, to hire a Chevron lawyer to prosecute Donziger. Now, I would note that her firm, that the lawyer's firm, which represented Chevron, has basically forced her out of the firm. Why? Because students at Harvard, Yale, and other major schools said they would not work for that firm. They can't hire now at Harvard. They're blocked because of their persecution of Donziger.
Really?
And I should say that the UN Human Rights Commission has a judicial panel, spent 2 years looking at the evidence, and determined that this was a case of political persecution, judicial misconduct, and the United Nations Human Rights Commission has judicial panels ordered the U.S. to release Donziger and to pay him compensation.
So is that
happening?
And
one final thing I should note, by the way, that if you're wondering about this judge and these judges in this case, Harvard University teaches Chevron v. Donziger as a case study in judicial misconduct. And right now, there are hearings on judicial misconduct on these judges. It's just, we've never had anything like it in America, ever.
So is Donziger in prison right now, or is he on home release, or what?
No, he's back under house arrest, waiting to go to prison for 6 months in a federal pen. He's temporarily released because of an appeal of the denial of bail in the hearing. In other words, the judge sentenced him to 6 months, said, I want you going from the courtroom to the jailhouse right now. Right. But they had no choice but to allow him to appeal the denial of bail. And let's put it this way. Where is this guy going? He had a misdemeanor. Why is he wearing an ankle bracelet? He's not the mafia. I've worked for the Justice Department. You don't put ankle bracelets on people unless they're going to flee the country. Yeah. He's got a family. It's punishment by Chevron.
Yeah, apparently. It's certainly what it sounds like, but wow. Greg Palast. GregPalast.com is the website. I'm assuming you have articles about this with documentation and links and things over at GregPalast.com, Greg?
You got it. Plenty.
Okay. And on Twitter, Greg_Palast. Greg, thanks a lot for dropping by.
You're very welcome, Tom.
And thank you for the update. Stick around. Tom Hartman here with you. June in British Columbia, Canada. Hey, June, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Okay, well, I just called because of all of this mess off the coast of California, mm-hmm. and apparently it's the court. And I just can't understand, or I wonder if I'm the only person that sees a connection to Elaine Chao's family's business, shipping, mm-hmm. marine electronics, and all of this mess off the coast. Hmm. Am I wrong? Is there a supply? It ultimately ends up being supply chain issue.
I'm guessing that you've got, this is just a guess, June. I've not ever seen any kind of authoritative investigative reporting on this.
New York Times wrote an article about this. So this is a short article in June of 2019.
Right. Yeah. I'm not talking about Elaine Chao's family. What I'm saying is, yes, I suspect that the supply chain problems that we have a couple of different factors that are driving them. Number one, you've got, you know, trucking shortages and trucker shortages, and you've got crew shortages for some of these large ships, or at least we did up until the last 6 months. And that was because people were literally dying of COVID on these ships. COVID was just running through ships and wiping out members of the crew and disabling members of the crew. And so, you know, for a number of months, basically, you had a lull in shipping in part because of that. Now everybody's vaccinated. Number two, you had a major recession. That was the first 6 months of, or the probably most of 2020, actually. and people weren't buying things. And so the supply chain kind of went down, right? Because we've gone, you know, this whole neoliberal thing that Reagan brought us, you know, it was celebrated. I remember in the 80s and 90s, Thomas Friedman talking about how wonderful it is. Everybody's doing just-in-time inventory. In other words, instead of having a factory where you stored things, you know, and then doled them out to your retail stores, you would go right from the China supplier to the port of Long Beach to a truck that would bring it to the Walmart in West Virginia, you know? And so those warehouses, like, literally don't even exist any longer. Everything is continuous supply chain. And that supply chain was depressed for a year, and now there's all that pent-up demand coming back. Just like after World War II, there was a period of inflation and shortages in the late 40s and early 50s that was, again, the result of people coming back from World War II, the economy bouncing back, and a sudden surge of demand after 5 years of suppressed demand. And that demand couldn't be met by supply rapidly enough, and that produces inflation and it produces bottlenecks. And I think that it's compounded by, you know, people in the industry that is moving things having gotten sick with COVID. But I think the principal thing is just this cycle of you know, a depressed economy followed by a red hot economy. And then with regard to things like lumber, I mean, we replaced a deck on our house a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, the wood was like three times what it should, you know, what it normally would cost. That in part is because we're having natural disasters in the United States like we never had before. You had this massive cold spell in Texas that went all the way down to Texas, you know, just, what, 8, 10 months ago.
Right.
That destroyed or damaged hundreds of thousands of houses. And then you had two really consequential hurricanes up the East Coast that went way deep inside America, places where they typically don't, and massive flooding throughout the Midwest, all of it damaging homes and creating demand for goods that we just don't make in America anymore, thanks to Reagan and Clinton and neoliberalism. All that stuff is stuff we're importing from China. And so you've got ships that are packed with wood, that are packed with sheetrock, that are packed with, you know, electrical. So, I mean, it's just, it's a perfect storm, in my opinion, June.
Yes, I agree.
So how does this tie into Elaine Chao's family, who owns, you know, one of the bigger shipping companies in the world, but certainly they're not the major supplier to the United States?
No, but that's true. But it was a thought that I had, and I appreciate you explaining it that way, because I'm so on the edge anymore, I'm so on the ledge anymore that I feel, you know, super sensitive about any of this stuff.
Yeah.
Because we're all being, you know, directed toward conspiracy theories.
Yeah. I think we need to take a deep breath.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To take a deep breath.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I hope I'm helping you with that. This is a natural cycle that we saw. It's almost a blow-by-blow replay of what we saw in 1946, 47, 48. You go back and look at the history of the time, and that echoed right up until the early 50s. But that was a much longer, I mean, you know, we were in the war for multiple years. We were only in COVID for, you know, in a bad way, you know, an economically depressed way for around 10 months. And Biden gave a press conference or a speech where he said, we're going to do a 90-day sprint to try to fix this. And they're running the ports now 24/7 and doing things like that. So I think we're going to see this resolved. June, thank you for the call. Your concerns, I'm sure, are probably shared by many people. Thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to address them.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
So are people rejecting the do you want fries with that economy and this whole minimum wage thing? I mean, we're seeing changes in employment patterns. We're seeing upsets in our supply chains. To what extent are these changes long-term or short-term? How do they change our economy? How much of this is just the result of 700,000 dead and probably several million disabled Americans as a consequence of COVID dropping out of the workforce? Or is there a larger trend here where people are saying, I don't really want to be just, you know, making a living saying, do you want fries with that anymore? 4.3 million workers quit their jobs in the last month, according to a screaming, hysterical headline over on Drudge. The number leaving restaurant jobs and hotels has doubled. Half of Americans say they want to make a career change. On the line with us is Professor Richard Wolff, the economist, co-founder of democracyatwork.info, the author of numerous books, his most recent, The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself, also available as an ebook. You can tweet him at Prof. Wolff. Professor Wolff, what say you about all this?
Well, I think it deserves a screaming headline. We've never seen numbers, they're called quits in the statistics that the government maintains. Millions of our fellow citizens are quitting their jobs, and everybody is wondering what's going on and connecting this phenomena to the so-called shortage of labor as our business community screams that there aren't enough workers. I want to give you an analysis of this that you're not going to get too often in the mainstream media for reasons that you and I could speculate on, but I'll leave for another time. There's a simple story in economics about what happens if you're short of labor. You need to offer higher wages and better working conditions, and then you can see whether the shortage is eliminated because you've made it worthwhile for people to come to work. Our business employer community doesn't want to do that. And for me, that's the core problem. We are facing a situation where, for the last 18 months at least, corporations have not made the kinds of profits, with a few exceptions, of course. Amazon did well, and Facebook did, and so on. But for the vast majority of our corporations, it's been a rough 18 months, and they want to recoup the losses that they suffered. And how are they doing that? By bringing their workers back into conditions that are less good than they even were before, so that the company can save on the money it might cost at wages that are not very good, are certainly not better than what they were before. And for the few who've had some increase in their wages, the rising inflation has wiped it all out. So what do we got? We got a working class, which also had 18 months of great difficulty, coming back to jobs that are lousy in their quality, don't pay very well, at a time when they need more money just to stay even with rising prices, and they're not getting that. I don't see why people are surprised that we have a revolt and a statement of saying, I'm not working here anymore. This is intolerable. And I think the proof of the pudding lies in another statistic, which should be alongside the quit statistic. We have a record number of strikes going on in this country. Over the summer, Nabisco, right now Kellogg, John Deere, bus drivers in Maryland, I'm just reading off a list, janitors at the Denver airport, the nurses' strike in St. Vincent's Hospital in Worcester, Massachusetts, the musicians at San Antonio, Texas Symphony. I tried to collect just a small portion. Those workers are furious at what is being done to them. 60,000 workers are just voted 98% to call a strike that will shut down a TV and film production in Hollywood. I mean, we're seeing workers saying no. And I think there's a very deep issue here, which is that the conflict between the employers and the employees that has been caused by the three crashes we've had this century already, and now by the pandemic, and now on top of that, by the desire of the employers to recoup what they lost in the pandemic at working people's expense, it's too much, and it is driving people both politically to go in directions they haven't in the past, and now on the job, or maybe I should say off the job at the same time.
Is this a symptom also? I mean, we have millions of people leaving jobs that are typically called so-called low-wage jobs. But I was in Chicago during the I think it's called the hotel workers strike. I'm forgetting the name of the union, but you had so-called low-wage workers who have unionized, and now they've got decent wages and benefits, and they were striking for better wages and benefits. But, when Reagan came into office, about a third of America was unionized. Now 6% of the private economy, in fact, it might even be below that now, is unionized. To what extent is this, people are doing what a union would do otherwise, only they're just walking away rather than saying we're going to strike for better wages and benefits because they don't have a union, so they can't strike.
Absolutely. And I think you're seeing the old wisdom. A union is an important organization for workers. But if they don't have one, they're not going to sit quietly and not act. They're going to do things. If the union movement understands this, this is an opportunity to do the organizing to reverse the last 70 years of decline to the 6% of the private sector that you're quite right is all that's organized now. The workers have been taking it on the chin, in part because their unions have declined and become weaker, and they got to see the writing on the wall, and I think they've seen it. And I think that's why we're having record strikes, we're having record quits. I think the sadness is that the workers who quit will discover that the job they think they can go to is going to be subjecting them to many of the same pressures, that they need a national coordinated push to change the terms of the deal between employer and employee. Otherwise, if they all do it on their own individually, they will have forgotten the lesson that is buried in the word union, that together we have a strength that separately we don't have. And I think you're seeing an American working class relearning that lesson. And if I'm right, we're in for quite some times ahead as this issue gets fought out.
Now, one of the narratives that we see particularly, well, it's not even on the right. I think of it as kind of a neoliberal narrative, but is that A, you've got people who aren't in the workforce right now because over 40 million Americans have been infected with COVID, and it's looking like at least a third of them are having long-term health consequences as a result of it, ranging from weakness to dementia. So that's taking a number of people, the ones who didn't die. Most of the deaths initially anyway were in people who were outside the workforce anyway because they're over 65. But now, it's disabling people. And then number two, that because of COVID and the Republican hysteria around masks and vaccines and things, but particularly masks, people are unwilling to work in jobs where they have to confront these mask holes who come in and try to confront people and get in fights with them. Nobody wants to be a clerk at a store anymore and be the one who has to say to some Republican, no, you've got to lift that mask up over your nose and possibly get shot. I mean, that happened last week. Somebody got shot for simply asking somebody to put on a mask. That those two dynamics of disabled workers from COVID and people who are unwilling to work in a hostile work environment created by Republican hysteria, that those two things will wash out of the economy over the next 3 years as Republicans no longer see a political advantage in this, as the COVID crisis starts to wane, and as new people come into the, younger people come into the workforce to replace those people who've been disabled by COVID. Do you think there's anything to that? I mean, how much, is that a small factor, a large factor, no factor at all?
I think that's a small factor. I think you're dealing here with much more fundamental roots of our economy. Take, for example, the mandates. The people that are objecting to mandates are the same people who don't object to lots of other mandates. If you assume, for example, if you pass an intersection in your car and the light turns red, that's the government which organized that light and which runs that light and will arrest you if you don't observe the law imposed on you to stop your vehicle when the light is red so you don't kill everybody. And people understand it. it, they accept it. The same person who accepts that is all bent out of shape because they have a mandate to wear a mask, which has the same logic of saving lives behind it. When people act in that contradictory, irrational way, the problem has to be understood. What is going on here? It isn't what it says it is. This isn't about a mandate about masks. This is people who have had enough, who are angry, who don't know quite where to put their anger, whether they understand that it's their wages that are no good, or the prices rising that they can't afford, or the job conditions that are unbearable, or the COVID disaster that struck their grandmother, or whatever it is. And so they're casting about, as people will, for something to attach their upset to. And there come the Republicans with an opportunity to hold on to some political advantage by getting behind the crazy gesture that troubled people focus on until they kind of clear their head and realize that's not their problem. I think you're seeing that spread across the country.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. And in a way, it's kind of reassuring that that would be a small part of the issue here. Professor Richard Wolff, always great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Professor Wolff's website's democracyatwork.info. His new book, The Sickness is the System.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is Tell the Bosses We're Coming by Sean Richman. The subtitle, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. This is from the first chapter, chapter one, titled The System is a Trap. Why can't unions grow? In an age of rampant inequality, at a time of increasing social protest, including a notable uptick in workers' strikes, and when a majority of workers say they want to be union members, why does union density continue to decline? The reason is we have structural problems, lots of them, one piled atop the other. The system of labor relations that came out of the New Deal and matured in the post-Second World War era has evolved into a complex and insidious trap. This trap prevents workers who want to join unions from legally doing so. It legally restricts workers' rights to protest our routine use and abuse by rich and powerful corporations. It confines unions to sectors of the economy that are not growing. It gives bosses veto power over whether a new union can even be formed in a workplace. It sharply narrows the scope of issues that unions can even put on the bargaining table. The combination of exclusive union representation, mandatory agency fees, no-strike clauses, and so-called management rights are the foundations of our peculiar union shop. No other country structures its labor relations systems quite like this. Our labor system didn't always look like this. It developed through a series of historical accidents. It has been made unworkable by a dogged anti-union legal campaign run by the vast right-wing conspiracy of think tanks, industry lobbyists, and bloodthirsty billionaires. The system has become a trap. Part of that trap, however, is in our own heads. Too many union activists and allies take for granted what a union is, how it should be organized, and what collective bargaining looks like. There's an analogy that makes the rounds in Cornell University's labor extension program. It involves a man sharing his grandma's pot roast recipe with a friend. First step of the recipe calls for cutting the ends off the raw rump, which prompts the friend to ask, "Really? Does that, like, make the roast more tender, or what?" The man sharing the recipe, who had never questioned why it calls for the ends to be cut off, calls his mom to ask why the recipe calls for the ends of the rump roast to be cut off. She confesses that she never thought about it either, and suggests that her older sister might know. So the man proceeds to call his aunt, who is similarly thrown off by the simple question. She had never questioned why the recipe called for this little bit of home butchery. All she knows is that the dish she made when following the recipe tasted good. It tasted familiar. And so on and so forth, as this man calls through family historians and home cooks until he finally visits his grandma at the nursing home. And she dismissively explains, "Oh, it's because the grocer only sold rump roasts that were too big for our roast pan." Oops. This is the most devastatingly on-the-nose analogy for how unions engage in long-term strategy. This is more face-to-face organizing conversations in existing union shops and networks of trained workplace leaders would revitalize many unions. But these won't grow the labor union in any movement in any appreciable way because they're still trapped in a rotten anti-labor, anti-union system. How can I so casually and confidently assert that more organizing won't significantly add to the ranks of union membership? Because it hasn't. We are nearly a quarter century into what I call the organize or die push by unions to significantly increase the amount of money and energy they spend on new union organizing. Of course, when it comes to organizing, many unions talk the talk but fail to walk the walk. I'll discuss some of those reasons why in Chapter 4. However, there are unions that have developed and actually maintained fidelity to organizing model strategies, putting hundreds of organizers in the field and successfully organizing thousands of bargaining units and new union members. These unions have survived, but they have not thrived. They have not greatly increased their density or their power. And the millions of workers who want to be union members remain outside the labor movement's ranks. When most of us speak of the organizing model, we are talking about methods of organizing within our broken system that may vary from each other slightly, but are all informed by the research of Dr. Kate Bronfenbrenner at Cornell. Dr. Bronfenbrenner identified 10 comprehensive organizing tactics from her own previous organizing experience. These include, number one, adequate and appropriate staff and financial resources. This means not just putting enough staff organizers on the ground, she recommends a ratio of one staffer for every 100 workers, but also research and communications support to take out ads, hold rallies, get buttons and t-shirts for the activists. The book is Tell the Bosses We're Coming by Sean Richmond. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
How about talk about union workers and the multiple strikes and potential strikes that are going on in the country right now, and how that can really give us leverage? I think that's what's been missing for the last 40 years, is the power of unions.
Yeah, well, the unions don't have a whole lot of power because of a whole series of Supreme Court decisions and Reagan's actions, but are you thinking that this labor shortage we're experiencing right now is going to drive that, or what?
There's a lot of things going on right now. The media will not, you know, report on this, but, you know, right now they're trying, I think there's about quite a few thousand trying to unionize down in the Hollywood and the ones going on with the miners in Alabama.
Yep.
We hear nothing about this because it's all corporate owned.
Well, it was the Amazon workers down in Alabama, wasn't it?
Well, there's some miners, you know, coal miners down there as well.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You know,
okay.
Yeah, there's, I think there's about 700 coal miners. Didn't you hear about them? They went to New York where I guess the company headquarters are, and they mm-hmm. did some striking there. And, you know, they gave concessions a few years. Now they're wanting to get their payback, but
right.
We hear nothing about this, and it's mind-boggling.
Well, in fact, what we heard is the opposite. What we heard from not only Republicans, but media echoing these Republican talking points right up until the last couple of weeks, was that the reason that there's a, quote, labor shortage in America right now was because we were generously giving people $300 a week in unemployment benefits, additional unemployment benefits, and therefore, I mean, who wants to go to work when you're getting $300 a week just appearing in your checking accounts? And people were just sitting around, you know, sitting on their couch eating bonbons and ordering in, lobster and sipping champagne as they were waiting for the benefits to run out. Well, what happened was in the Republican-controlled states, they actually started cutting the benefits off in August, many of them. The benefits officially ended in early September, wasn't it? I think it was the first week of September. So in the red states, you would have seen it in the August jobs reports. If cutting people off from that $300 forced them back into the workplace, you would have seen a big pop in employment numbers in the red states in August and every place else in September. And instead, we saw the numbers for August and September. And in both cases, in fact, in September, the labor force shrank for the first time since May. I mean, you know, this Laura Klausner has a great piece about this over at Daily Kos right now. So it turns out it wasn't the $300 a week. The reason that people aren't going back to work is, number one, you've got parents who have kids at home, and there's no daycare available to them, or if there is, they can't afford it. You got people with health issues who don't want to be exposed to COVID in the workplace, and you don't have a lot of really safe workplaces, and so people don't feel, you know, safe about this. And you've got some workers who are thinking, you know, maybe I'll look for a decent wage. We had all these employers who were running around going, oh, these people are just lazy and we can't find anybody to work. And then suddenly, you know, when they go from offering $10 an hour to offering $12 or $15 an hour, oh, hey, now we've got all kinds of people. So, you know, it's really about the fact that we were being lied to by Republicans and business owners about this whole thing. Jeff, thank you. Thank you. Excellent point. Thank you. Reggie in Springfield, Missouri. Hey, Reggie, thanks for listening to us on SiriusXM. What's up?
Tom, I'm a retired union leader for the Laborers Union, and they have pretty much destroyed the prevailing wage here in Missouri. Used to, the prevailing wage was based on how many hours was worked in a given year at that particular wage, and it was always the unions that turned in the wages.
Right.
And got the prevailing wage set up. Well, here in Missouri, thanks to our governor and our attorney general, they've went out and recruited house builders and residential irrigation people and stuff like that, and they've got a prevailing wage drop down to, in a lot of our counties, what the federal minimum wage is.
And wow. That's on the federal. Now, the reason, Reggie, people may not realize why this is so important. There are federal laws that, for example, if Biden's Build Back Better, there are federal laws that say if federal funds are used to build a new bridge in Missouri, the people working on that have to be paid the prevailing wage. And historically, you're right, that has been basically the union wage or something close to it. But if they are bringing in low-wage people to stack those numbers, to change the prevailing wage numbers, that's a blow to everybody. This is something that we all need to pay attention to, by the way, because this is another piece of the Republican war on working class Americans. This is a war that was declared in 1980, and they have not stopped, and they are not going to stop.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.